and welcome to another edition of Not Another Sports Show, your progressive look at the world of sports here on WRFU 104.5 FM LP. And before we get started, as always,
our little disclaimer. WRFU is an open forum for the Urbana Champaign community. Views expressed are those of the speakers and are not intended to represent WRFU, the UCIMC, or the Urbana Socialist Forum.
And with us this week, we're going to be talking about sports, cultural appropriation, and racism, and we're lucky to have community activist Thomas Garza with us in the house.
How's it going?
You can also catch This Indigenous Life Wednesdays from 6 to 7, I think?
Wednesdays 6 to 7, that's right.
Awesome. Okay, well, news of the week. We've got a lot here in the world of sports and labor specifically. In the aftermath of the unfortunate death of Chicago Bears player Gaines Adams at age 26 due to a heart attack from an enlarged heart that went undetected, the NFL's cardiovascular committee began discussing the possibility of subjecting all players to an echocardiogram heart scan, starting with potential draft picks drafted in the NFL scouting combine next month. The NFL Players Association's medical director, Thomas Mayer, told ESPN that the medical examiner who performed an autopsy on Adams stated the enlarged heart had led to his death could have been detected by such an echocardiogram. Currently, these echocardiograms are only ordered when a player has an abnormal EKG or has a family history of heart problems. And after the Players Association reviewed Adams' medical files, dating back to his entry into the league, his EKG and his family history were normal.
Yeah, but I mean, this just raises that broader issue, right? You know, all the different sorts of occupational health issues around athletics. You know, we'd been talking about the whole head injury and concussion issue in football, and I mean, this is just another thing to keep an eye on.
And
you know, it's a rough profession.
With the issue about concussions, when he specifically talked about that in a previous show, we discussed the economies of scale and how once the NFL takes a very strong stance on concussions, that's going to leak down to the NCAA, to high school games, and that's starting to see some very positive results. The NCAA has begun studying concussions and making recommendations about player safety,
mm-hmm.
and now at least six states are crafting their own legislation to strengthen regulations about when players can return after head injuries.
Right, right. So, yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. It's like the NFL is, you know, they're the leader in that sport, right? So, you know, others follow, but they're kind of the forerunner for a lot of these sorts of things. So yeah, that's interesting. Let's see, what else do we have here? Yeah, this is kind of a funny story. So there's this marathon that they have in China, right? And apparently it's extremely competitive. This most recent one that they had, they discovered that 1/3 of the top 100 people who placed in the marathon were actually cheating at some point along the way. And, I mean, they were creative about their cheating, right? Some, like, started out the race just fine and then hopped into a car in some alley and drove part of the way.
A little homage to Rosie Ruiz.
it's creative, right? And some of them, I guess, so they had these timing microchips that they were supposed to wear, right? So when they crossed the finish line, some people just, like, tagged their microchip onto someone else who placed ahead of them. So you had, like, you know, three or four people who placed exactly at the same, like, millisecond across the line, you know? It's funny, but it's also kind of sad. Because apparently, like getting into a college or university in China is so competitive that, you know, winning something like this gives people a little bit of an edge. And so, like, they're cheating, but they're cheating to get their place to get a higher education or something like that. You know, so it's kind of sad, but on the other hand, it's also kind of funny. So this was the Xiamen Marathon, I guess what was it? It was like finishing the race under 2 minutes and 2 hours and 34 seconds, right? Adds valuable points to their scores, like this entrance exam is the all important thing there. So it adds points to that entrance exam. So sad.
Yeah, sad. I think even some imposters got hired.
Yeah. They had ringers brought in. oh well.
Any usage of pets or like carrier pigeons or anything like that?
That'd be hilarious. Actually, there was like an Onion article a while ago where they charged someone or he was believed to have cheated by using a performance enhancing horse. They had a picture of him actually riding a horse, and it's like, we're not sure, but we think he may have been using horse. Yeah, no, it's interesting, kind of funny, kind of sad, just an interesting commentary on the situation over there in China.
But, Kelly Kulik became the first woman to win a Professional Bowlers Association title Sunday at the Tournament of Champions in Las Vegas. She won by beating 2007-2008 PBA Player of the Year Chris Barnes by over 70 pins, 265-195. So she's the first woman to ever win a PBA title.
Good for her.
Quite nice.
I mean, for someone who can barely bowl over 100.
Hey, I still need bumpers.
Okay. No, but that's excellent news. Another interesting, first for women in sports. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing the name right. Is it Marlos Conan?
Works for me.
Anyway, a Dutch female mixed martial artist. We'll be fighting Chris Cyborg January 31st. That's tomorrow, I guess. She has said, though, that her biggest goal as a fighter is to inspire other women to join mixed martial arts. To quote her, she said, I'm from a very small town in the east of the Netherlands, and I had to ride my bike a long way to school, and all my friends went to a different school. She also went on to say, that meant I was by myself for a long time every day, and I wanted to learn how to defend myself because I was concerned about that. So I took martial arts classes, and I found a Brazilian jiu-jitsu teacher, and he also started to show me mixed martial arts, and he told me I should fight. So this will be an interesting interesting contest to have a look at, to watch. Good for her.
And from what I can tell, she's actually somewhat of a submission artist, too, and she said that's a problem when you're fighting in the Netherlands because they have no interest in watching a fight go to the ground and watch submissions get applied, whereas in the U.S., you know, we're more interested in not only watching strikers, but also watching submissions and watching a fight get to the mat.
Sure.
And so it's good to see that, you know, she's starting to get, you know, taking something that was defensive and turning this into something that can be empowering for people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Going from a little bit of empowering to more community activism, Minnesota Vikings owner Ziggy Wilf. Oh, and just editorial comment. Ha ha, Brett Favre.
Oh.
You lost. Have fun in Mississippi. No, please don't come back. Please don't like make us spend the entire summer wondering if you're going to retire.
Oh, that's a little hard. I mean, didn't you kind of feel bad for him taking all those?
No.
Okay.
No, I didn't. He made me spend an entire summer. Is Brett Favre going to come back? Is Brett Favre going to come back? Uh-huh. We're in Brett Favre's front lawn. Oh, Brett Favre went out to the Taco Bell. Brett Favre, we think he's in the bathroom right now. Brett Favre took a breath, everybody. Breaking news on ESPN.
Okay, fair enough.
Well, the Vikings owner, Ziggy Wilf, is going to be at the Minnesota State Legislature on February 4th, 3 days before the Super Bowl, to press for a new $1 billion stadium with $700 million to be paid by the taxpayers. And the Vikings are threatening moving their franchise to Los Angeles if they don't get their nine-figure welfare check. This is just after Carl Pollad's Twins got a new stadium that's going to be opening this season with $353 million coming in corporate welfare from the taxpayers.
It's amazing, you know, whether the economy is looking good or not. They somehow have the gall to just ask for huge amounts of money like this, you know? I mean, that's not small change.
Well, you know, when the Mets got bought out by Citibank, I think they should have called it Taxpayer Field, because we owned the bank at that time, they still bought a controlling interest in that field.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. That's crazy. Anyway, I guess we've got more BCS news.
Yes.
Did you want to take it, or...?
Oh, go for it, because okay. I've got an update that I just saw this morning when I was looking at the news.
Okay. So anyway, college football may be over, but the dastardly legacy of the BCS lives on. Five conferences that don't get automatic bids to the Bowl Championship Series will receive a record $24 million from this year's BCS Bowl games, augmented by the Tostitos Fiesta Bowl matchup of TCU and Boise State. BCS figures obtained by the Associated Press on Monday show the bulk of that money will go to TCU's Mountain West Conference, $9.8 million, I'm sorry, $9.8 million of that goes to the Mountain West Conference, and Boise State's Western Athletic Conference gets $7.8 million. As non-BCS leagues sent two teams into the Premier Bowls for the first time. The other three non-BCS conferences will divide the remainder. The figures still lag behind the six BCS conferences, and the Big Ten and the Southeast conferences received $22.2 million each, with $17.7 million going to each of the other four BCS conferences. The Obama administration is working in bipartisan fashion with Republican Senator Orrin Hatch by having the Justice Department potentially open an investigation against the BCS for violation of antitrust laws, or having the Federal Trade Commission open an investigation to see if the BCS meets consumer protection laws. So,
yeah, at least something's getting done in a bipartisan fashion in this country.
Yeah, at least there's something that both Democrats and Republicans can agree on something.
Yes, we can all agree that this bowl championship series is an absolutely terrible way to have a system to determine a national champion when it comes to men's football.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, we may disagree on, you know, right to, you know, good health and pursuit of happiness and all that stuff, but yeah, at least, you know, agree on the BCS.
Yeah, never before did I think would say statements like, I agree with Orrin Hatch.
And you may never again outside of this context, but
very true. Speaking of college playoffs for men's football, sports entertainment marketing giant IMG is working towards starting a national championship for high school football. It's still in the developmental stages, obviously, but it is going to be something that we're going to keep watching, because if this is anything like the BCS, this is, you know, when are we going to get, like, the grade school national championships?
Crazy. Let's see, what else do we have
here? Oh, I've got to take this story about
Paul Shirley. Do you want to do this one? It is pretty funny. Okay, go ahead.
former NBA player and now former ESPN columnist Paul Shirley recently published his thoughts about Haiti, and he was canned from ESPN for these comments that he published on another website. In these comments, he vowed not to donate to the Haiti relief efforts, likening to giving a dollar to a homeless man, saying, quote, I don't think the people of Haiti will do much with my money either. And here's an excerpt in the form of a hypothetical message from the world to Haiti. Quote, Dear Haitians, first of all, kudos on developing the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. Your commitment to human rights, infrastructure, and birth control should be applauded. As we prepare to assist you in this difficult time, a polite request. If it's possible, could you not rebuild your island home in the image of its predecessor? Could you not resort to the creation of flimsy shanty and shack towns? And could some of you maybe use a condom once in a while? Sincerely, the rest of the world.
As if it was their choice to live like that.
Yes.
Right? I mean, as if the whole history of Western imperialism that was, you know, projected onto that poor little country had nothing at all to do with that. That this was just purely by disgusting guy.
Yeah. You know, like...
But what made it so funny was the way ESPN just totally ran away from him, right? Like, I mean, they didn't just say he's fired. They were like... Not only is he not going to submit any more work to us anymore, but he was only a freelance contributor. We actually never employed him. We never had anything to do with him. We barely even know this guy.
We never met this guy.
Yeah. Who? Yeah, who was that? He's not working for us anymore. In fact, he never worked for us.
I know, that's crazy. You can talk about, you know, the fact that the French made the Haitians pay off their quote-unquote debt when they emancipated themselves as the slave republic, as the first emancipated black republic,
right.
The French demanded that they get money returned for all of those slaves, which from 1793 till 1947, the Haitians were paying off. The huge amount of debt that they owe the IMF and the World Bank.
The
fact that Major League Baseball and other places came in and set up baseball factories and sweatshops.
Mm-hmm.
All of these different things. We can sit here, you know, Truman sending in the Marines from 1915 mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. the 1930s. Had a very definite impact on these people.
Oh, absolutely.
And as Dave Zirin put it best, I was going to suggest that he actually try to live on a dollar a day or care for someone HIV positive who has no access to medicine. I wanted to dare him to work for only one day in a garment industry sweatshop. I was going to write all of these things, but instead I'm going to write my own open letter. Dear Paul Shirley, I only wish your father had taken your own advice and worn a condom. Go to hell. Sincerely, Dave Zirin.
That's hilarious. But no, you're absolutely right, though, with the, you know, I mean, talk about predatory lending, right? I mean, the IMF and the World Bank are just terrible for that. They're notorious for destroying third world countries with these loans. And countries, I know, like Venezuela forgave Haitian debt, and I imagine a few others have also.
But, I think I mean, France is even asking for them to forgive debt.
Right. Oh, the irony. But, let's see, what else do we have here? Oh, we have the Tennessee Titans center, Kevin, how do you pronounce it? Mawe?
I believe so.
Oh, okay. Let's see. He's the president of the players union for the NFL, and he says, it looks very bleak to get a deal done before March of this year or the beginning of the new NFL season. We're going to continue to try until we come to some terms of what's really important and what are the big issues in this deal. It's going to be tough to get something done. The players are more united than ever before, and we're preparing for a lockout. Now, it's looking like the main issue, of course, is money. Despite soaring TV ratings and an average team value of $1 billion, the NFL owners in 2008 have opted out of their contract, calling the Collective Bargaining Agreement, or CBA. That's called the Collective Bargaining Agreement, or CBA. And they've asked for significant givebacks from the players, including a reduction in salaries of nearly 20%. If no contract is reached, the following will be in place. Players will need 6 years in the league before becoming unrestricted free agents rather than four. Some veterans with less than 6 years in the league will become restricted free agents, meaning their current club will have the right to match an offer or be compensated for losing them. Eight clubs have made the divisional playoff round this year. That have made the divisional playoff rounds this year will have limits on signing unrestricted free agents under what's called the Final Eight Plan. The 32 teams would be relieved of their obligation to fund numerous player benefits programs, including retirement, player annuity, severance pay, and tuition assistance. That would be a reduction of more than $7 million per club. A supplemental revenue sharing plan will be scrapped by the league, which says about $100 million is involved. The union claims it's closer to $200 million. That's not a huge sum in the scheme of NFL finances, but it would still hurt clubs on the financial bottom rung. There'd be no salary floor or salary ceiling. So in 2009, the cap was $128 million, and the floor was $111 million. And getting rid of that, anybody's guess as to where salaries will go, right?
Yeah. Well, watch small market teams not sign many players or cut down costs as much as they can.
Mm-hmm.
And some of these larger teams that are already successful are going to have limitations put on them. So we could see potential losses in wages. And this looks to be a very, very contentious labor issue.
Absolutely.
Story that I found this morning while talking to my friend Dawn. Hi, Dawn. Major League Soccer and its players agreed Thursday to extend bargaining through February 12th in effort to avoid a work stoppage. Their league's five-year labor contract expires tomorrow, and players feared management would lock them out the following day, and that would be the soccer league's first labor stoppage. The sides negotiated Tuesday and Wednesday at the league offices without reaching a deal. Players want to modify the soccer's and single entity structure, in which all players sign with the league rather than with their individual teams, and that most players lack guaranteed contracts. Meanwhile, the NBA is also negotiating their own new contract. Currently, players make 57% of the league revenue, and Commissioner David Stern is allegedly going to offer 45% of the league revenue in his new proposal to help certain teams return to profitability. But the union wants close to a 50-50 deal, and they have until June 30th to work out a deal before a potential lockout or labor stoppage.
Oh, yeah. Well, and I guess unrelated news story, but something that's been getting a lot of attention. This Tim Tebow Focus on the Family Super Bowl ad. This is the ad where Tim Tebow and his mother were going to show up and talk about how, I guess, basically deliver a pro-life message.
Not an overt one, though.
Not an overt one, according to CBS, right? CBS approved the script of the ad, and according to the network spokesman, it does not appear to be changing its decision due to the protest. There's been a lot of protest around this. It issued this statement: "Our standards and practices process continues to adhere to a policy that ensures all ads on all sides of an issue are appropriate for air. However," and this is a relatively recent policy statement that they made, because in 2004, CBS refused to air an ad by the United Church of Christ describing the church's openness towards gays and others who might feel shunned by more conservative churches. CBS now claims that its current policy would have allowed the UCC ad to air. 30-second spots on CBS during the Super Bowl run in excess of $2.5 million. So it's not small change here. And, you know, turning down an ad like that would have meant a significant loss of revenue for them. The New York-based Women's Media Center has expressed its opposition to the pro-life Tebow ad. A quote from their spokesperson, or their president, rather, an ad that uses sports to divide rather than to unite has no place in the biggest national sports event of the year, an event designed to bring Americans together. This from Jamu Green, the president of the Media Center.
And, you know, there's been some really interesting blowback on this. I mean, you have people like Deadspin.com, one of their authors, noted quite aptly, "Do a famous football player and his mom have any business telling a national television audience, in coded language or otherwise, that we should all ignore science, pray extra hard, and hope that God rolls to the point in the great cramps game of human existence simply because he once rolled it for them?
Mm-hmm.
It's wonderful that everything worked out for the Tebows. That it what did was also, if the situation was indeed dire enough that doctors recommended terminating the pregnancy in a deeply Catholic country that criminalizes abortion, no less, extraordinarily lucky. The moment the family takes that private bit of providence and dangles it on television as a possibility for others, well, that's just the moment the family turns into another set of TV charlatans."
Mm-hmm.
"But wait, there's more. That fetus could win a Heisman." And that's dangerous stuff. They're telling women, even ones at risk, to gamble with their health. What's so pro-life about that?
Yeah.
And we've also got Gloria Allred questioning the veracity of Pam Tebow's claims and declaring that besides being controversial propaganda, it may violate federal law banning misleading advertising. She said that she doubts Tebow's claims because since 1930, abortion has been illegal in the Catholic country, the Philippines, and that the anti-abortion laws are so strict in the Philippines, exceptions are not even allowed for rape or incest or the health of the mother. And there's no law in the Philippines that expressly authorizes abortions to save a woman's life. So she believes that it's an impossible scenario that Filipino doctors would ever even suggest abortion as a viable option for Tebow in the first place.
That's interesting. So this could all just be a made-up story.
Yeah, potentially. I like to see where this goes.
No, yeah, definitely keep an eye out on this.
And Tim, before you even get drafted and get your big payday, you're stepping on the third rail right now.
Ouch.
But that was our news of the week, and you're listening to Not Another Sports Show here on WRFU 104.5. We'll be back in a minute to talk about Chief Alinawak, cultural appropriation, and racism as it deals with the history of sports. You're listening to WRFU 104.5 FM.
We're told that after the war, the Nazis vanished without a trace. But the Italians, the fascists, still dream of a master race. The history books, they tell of their defeat in 45. But they all came out of the woodwork on the day the Nazi died. They say the prisoner of Spandau was a symbol of defeat. Was Hess remained in prison, then the fascists, they were beat. So the promise of an Aryan world would never materialize.
So why did they all come out of the woodwork
on the day the Nazi died? The world is riddled with maggots, the maggots are getting fat. They're making a tasty meal of all the bosses and bureaucrats. They're taking over the boardrooms and they're fat and full of pride. And they all came out of the woodwork on the day the Nazi died. So if you meet with these historians, I'll tell you what to say. Tell them that the Nazis never really went away. They're out there burning houses down and peddling racist lies. And we'll never rest again until every Nazi dies.
Hey, and that was back after a brief song. Yes, it was only a minute. I thought I had another song on here, so I am currently just wasting a little bit of time while I'm searching for it, found it. Okay, back to some music. We'll be back in a second.
Chris Columbus, a man of his time, slaughtered Arawak natives to further his kind, and they stayed of mind, and their take on the divine allowed them to be so inclined to send ships with guns, filled with men with swords, so filled with the love of the Lord that they do whatever's necessary for their position. Death is the decision when they on a mission. Death is the decision when they on a mission. What we talking about?
Imperialism.
Death is the decision when they on a mission. What we talking about?
Yeah. Imperialism.
Yeah. Every second Monday in October, we hold a celebration for a Western soldier who brought over a culture manifestly destined to rule and take over. Funny how in the name of Jehovah, you supposed to be the landowner more so than the first holder. Ask the natives in Plymouth about the caravan next to the boulder. From what they told ya in high school about righteous conquest and brave explorers. Little revealed about the millions killed with the government will try to seal up the horror. Hey, the superpowers locked in the chess match. Like cool cats, they sit back and see who is this batch. Resist that, do the tax, promote armed attacks. We give packs plus import crack. Now tell me what you think about that. Do it sound familiar to me too, cousin, I feel ya. And all because I picked up a book, then looked and was shook by the shit these crooks done took. Chris Columbus, a man of his time, slaughtered Arawak natives to further his kind, and they stayed of mind, and their take on the divine allowed them to be so inclined to send ships with guns, filled with men with swords, so filled with the love of the Lord that they do whatever's necessary for their position. Death is the decision when they on a mission. Death is the decision when they on a mission. What we talking about?
Imperialism.
Death is the decision when they on a mission. What we talking about?
Imperialism.
Hey, but not long after the shock of being enslaved, recovery efforts are made to educate the people depraved, terrorized in a way diabolical, physical, psychological, part of an economical interest, an ill-fated frozen tempest of humanity's ultimate sin fest. The obliteration of braves and a savage middle passes to a civilized way, mixed and mingled by the gringos, given new lingo plus Chris Gringo, decimated families to singles, mijo, thank God for Santo Domingo. And it's with the plantation jingles, songs of freedom, hit the drums, it's time to beat them, teach them about the blood and shed for the love of who we are.
Petit Lomature,
Chris Columbus, a man of his time, saw the Arawak natives the furthest of his kind, and they stayed of mind, and their take on the divine allowed them to be so inclined to send ships with guns, filled with men with swords, so filled with the love of the Lord that they do whatever's necessary for their position. Death is the decision when they on a mission. Death is the decision when they on a mission. What we talking about?
Imperialism.
Death is the decision when they on a mission. What we talking about?
Imperialism.
I wanna leave you till all.
Okay, hello, and we're back after our brief musical interlude. Trying to find a couple of songs there. That was Head Rock's song, Chris Columbus, obviously with the radio edit, so we'd be able to play it due to the one naughty word that he tended to use in that one part. But it was on the topic of cultural appropriation and racism, and we have seen that quite extensively in the history of sports. Most specifically, you know, we've talked about it in the history of baseball, but even more specifically, we've got it right here at home with the quote-unquote Chief, if we want to call it that. So, Tom, why don't you tell us a little bit of history about the Chief and your work in the community about Chief Illiniwek and those issues.
Well, Chief Illiniwek comes out of a long, rich tradition in America of essentially Plain Indian, which is something that people have been, you know, the Boy Scouts, and even before that, there were groups that did it going all the way back to, if you want to count things like the Boston Tea Party, where a bunch of white men dressed up like natives and went out and attacked a boat as an excuse to behave, in transgressive ways. Essentially, what it is just like creating this concept of Indian as someone who behaves outside of civilized ways. And so, because they've created this sort of figure, you can map anything onto that you want to, essentially, that you want it to be. And that's where you get a lot of the bravery and the honor and all these different kinds of things that they have. So that's kind of where the tradition stems from, is just this I don't know what you call it. It's like a fantasy a sort of an achievable fantasy world that's just like right on the edge of what people consider everyday reality. So it lends itself to things like mascots and things like that. And so you have like the state of Illinois, which is named after the Illini Confederation, which was the native a bunch of different tribes that lived in this part of the country prior to the Europeans coming over. And so they named the state after them, and they of course named the college after those same people. And so it eventually seemed like an obvious thing to do, you know, to come up with a mascot that also reflected this quote-unquote heritage. And so back in the 20s, I think it was the 20s, the band leader came up with the idea of like, well, we'll just have somebody dress up like an Indian and come out and dance around at halftime. It'll just be an interesting, diverting thing to do. And so he got, I think it was the assistant band director, who was a Boy Scout and had been raised in that tradition. He invented his own costume and everything, and he came out and did this sort of suit of native dance thing. And over time, that caught on. It was just, it was something that appealed to a lot of people. And also, if you look through history of advertising and everything, you'll see that there's a lot of usage of native imagery in a number of different ways. So it's a very familiar and comfortable icon that people can wrap themselves around and just go, oh, yeah, that's familiar to me. And that's essentially where it started back then. And it's just been going and kind of building ever since, and they've developed this thing, a whole series of things around the presentation and the appreciation of the mascot that they call the Chief Illiniwek tradition. And it's just been in the community pretty much nonstop since the 20s until the NCAA came in. And you probably know more about that sort of thing. I don't really follow the politics of sports at all, but they essentially came in and decided that the mascot, that native mascots contributed to sort of a hostile and abusive atmosphere at schools that had them. And so they essentially would not allow, I think, is it the Big Ten? Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Something like that. There's some grouping of college sports. It's just you can't, if you have one of these mascots, you can't host a game, and you can't, a championship game, I think, and you can't bring your mascot to the thing. And this was also, I should jump back a little bit and say this was also in reaction to a number of schools who said they would not play our team if we brought that mascot to their school. So it's been ever since the 70s and the sort of resurgence of Native power when groups like the American Indian Movement and stuff started coming into the national scene and sort of, you know, demanding respect, the issue has come up and people have been having to deal with it in various ways. And so it's been building towards this point. And I think the NCAA just caught on to it and just said, you know, okay, that we should just get rid of all this stuff. We should just do it officially. And that's kind of where it officially ended. Although if you ask anybody on this campus, they probably see more Chief-related stuff now, and T-shirts and bumper stickers and whatnot, than they ever did before it was officially retired. So it's still very much here. It's just the person who dresses that way does not officially go out and dance anymore.
Right. Yeah. One of the most ironic bumper stickers for me was the Chief now, the Chief forever.
Yeah.
Which, being a historian, automatically harkened back to those days of Governor Wallace. Segregation now, segregation forever.
Very poorly chosen statement there.
And, you know, we have this very big, very vocal, at least, group of community members that are very supportive of the Chief. And in October of 2009, the university actually returned the regalia. Mm-hmm. And the only way I found out about it was a small little picture in the back of the News Gazette in the back of Section A with a short paragraph. And when I had contacted the university to get a statement, they had said that they wanted it to be a quiet, dignified event.
And I think part of the reason it had to be quiet and dignified is that you would have had a bunch of people throwing a fit if this was publicized that the university was actually giving back this regalia and basically admitting that they were in the wrong.
Yeah. I also think that timing was really, really crucial at that point. It was just a complete accident. But if you'll remember, at that point they were holding one of those things they called the Next Dance out at the assembly hall, and I'm willing to bet that they were planning on returning the regalia as part of sort of this big pompous ceremony thing, but we had planned a big demonstration against it, and because of that, I think they didn't want it to seem like they were doing it in response to our protest, and so they like canceled their plans on promoting it and just kind of did it. They couldn't get out of it at that point. I mean, this is just, maybe I'm wrong, but I just had this feeling, because it's so weird that they just, no publicity, nothing. I mean, people like that don't do, the university administration, corporations, nobody does anything without.
If there's an advantage for some PR points, they play it up for sure. Yeah. But no, I mean, you make some interesting points. You know, it's like, the way that a lot of people defend the chief and claim that it's a matter of respect, or they're trying to preserve some kind of dignity or something like that. It almost feeds into sort of this like revisionist history about how like Native cultures just sort of got assimilated into the white culture that later occupied the United States, and it sort of denies the fact that there really was this ongoing conflict. You know, I mean, a huge war. You know, and genocide basically. Against these folks, and now it's like you said, it's like a caricature now, and we can just they're noble, and we've incorporated all of the, all of these great attributes of this culture into our own. It just feels safe, I guess, for people, right?
Yeah, and I think you touched upon what I consider the key point here. The reason most people don't understand the problem with this thing is because they don't see it as a caricature. That stereotype is so ubiquitous and has been around for so long, like I was saying, ever since. In fact, I have a book, to jump out sideways here for a second. I have a book that I got a while back about Europeans writing about the American wilderness prior to and right at the point when they started coming over. Mm-hmm. And even then, they were romanticizing and exoticizing the native people here. They were either saying they were like children, like Garden of Eden, kind of like the perfect people living in peace and harmony, or they were wild savages just barely above beasts. So it was like one of the two. And this strange kind of dichotomous understanding of what Native people were has remained intact throughout. So they're both warlike and fierce and brave, and they're peaceful, noble, brave, spiritual,
Right.
Well, and somehow magically together. But my point was that I think you hit on exactly is that it is such a ubiquitous stereotype that they don't understand it as a stereotype. So they look at it and they go, okay, this is what Indians are. This is, the chief is a really good, very nice, respectful example of this thing that Indians are. Therefore, what's the problem? I don't see the problem.
Right. And somehow it sort of, it makes it feel like we've, it masks the violence of the occupation of the Americas. Yeah. It's like, we've incorporated this culture into our own. In some way, that's really not what happened. At all.
Well, what reminds me of is when you watch like things on PBS, you see movies about Rome or whatever. You're so used to seeing Greeks and Romans all speak with a British accent, because Western Europeans have traced their lineage back to Greece and Rome. Mm-hmm. It's not really even that connected to it, but they've just sort of co-opted. Like, well, what's something noble? Oh yeah, okay, Ancient Romans and Greeks, yeah, they're noble. Okay, that's part of our history.
Right.
That just becomes us. Mm-hmm. And so they've co-opted it. And in the same way, Europeans coming here, they're like, well, how can we sort of like plant our flag on this soil in a sort of a more spiritual, way? And it's, oh, we'll just co-opt it. It's like, so you hear things like the resolution the university had at one point of honoring our native heritage. Well, how is it our native heritage? You got a bunch of French and English and Italian people who come here and settle, and then they call it our native heritage, but it isn't. It's not their native heritage at all.
That's right.
They've just like they borrow it in order to give themselves sort of a justification and an authenticity that they don't really feel that they have.
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely.
You know, and the next dance that keeps coming up of I was always amazed at the fact that, you know, we're honoring the Illini, but, you know, we're wearing Lakota garb.
Mm-hmm.
And we're honoring the Illini by having a white boy go to, you know, to turn him Native American in a period of 2 weeks over a Boy Scout camp. Suddenly, you know, made this some sort of, you know, real issue. And I remember being a student at the university when Chancellor Cantor at the time said, you know, perhaps it's time that we dump the chief back in 2005. And there were billboards that got put up saying, yeah, you know, it's time to dump Cantor. And just this outright defensiveness about, you know, this, you know, this mascot.
Yeah.
And, you know, even watching the old videos from the Next Dance part where it's like, I believe the chief stands for dignity and honor. Now get out of my way! And then starts cursing at people while he's trying to hit them.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny. I would argue that even in a larger sense that Native Americans, Native people, which we've kind of all sort of brought together and turned into this one thing that we call Indians, are really like, are not like a local mascot. They're like America's mascot. It's on our money. You know, you see these pictures on the back of dollar bills and on coins and Capitol buildings, and everywhere you look, you see this. It's a national logo and mascot. So I think to a lot of people, it's sort of a patriotic thing. It's like, if you're saying there's something wrong with that, there's something wrong with America, in the sense that they like to think of it. In a very real way, that's true. Because if you start to question our history vis-a-vis the Native people of this continent, there's some serious problems there. And you very quickly lose the legitimacy of the United States of America if you go back and ask, how did we end up here and how did this become your land and our land? You know what I mean? So I don't think it's stupidity. I think people are actually kind of blocking. It's like saying, I just don't want to go there. Just leave this alone, because if we start looking at this too carefully, that opens up this whole can of worms that goes all the way back, and I can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So I think it's really understandable why people are so defensive of this thing. It really makes sense to me. I think it's wrong, but I do understand it, I think.
Even, you know, we have other issues outside of the chief line. Like, Damien's a alum of the University of North Dakota.
That's right.
With the Fighting Sioux that we talked a little bit about last week. And we even got into the Peoria Chinks.
Pekin Chinks.
Or the Pekin Chinks. Sorry, Peoria. I didn't mean to slime you there.
Yeah.
What?
Don't want any hate mail coming flooding in from Peoria.
We have a lot of listeners in Peoria.
Sure. Yes. We have a lot of influence. After all, this is the international left-wing conspiracy.
Right. Liberal media over here.
And, you know, just recently we also had the Russian ice dancers. Probably the only time we're going to ever discuss ice dancing, let alone Russian ice dancing.
Oh, yeah, was that the Aboriginal?
Yeah, where they dressed up as faux Aboriginals, and they said they saw it on YouTube, and they think they've done it justice based on a YouTube video.
Well, heck yeah.
No. I mean, you have to spend those 2 weeks in that camp to really legitimately...
Yeah. Be fair now. Yeah. 2 weeks in camp. That's enough to get it. I mean, what is it? It's primitive. What is it?
Yeah.
You know, a couple weeks. Figure it out. Put some feathers in your hair. You're done.
Oh, and you just recently... saw the news reports about the Students for the Chief trying to make the mountain out of the molehill of the university, supposedly trying to shut down the Next Dance.
Mm-hmm.
And having seen the protest at both years when they've tried the Next Dance, and even trying to get in contact with Students for the Chief about different stuff, they never get back to me about anything.
Mm, interesting.
Yeah. And just trying to see, you know, like, this faux outrage of, like, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, the event took place,
yep.
1,800 people saw a white boy dance around in a fake outfit, and no free speech rights were really trampled on. You had people in the administration who didn't necessarily like it since the chief's been gone since 2007.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't get where their outrage is coming from to, you know, put up these, you know, FOIA request, like, you know, to write their FOIA request and then say, you know, our rights were trampled on. I'm looking at their website right now and says, no student rights were violated. Freedom of Information Act request reveals that administrators at the Urbana campus of the University of Illinois conspired dun, 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 against UI students and specifically students for Chief Illiniwek during the planning of the next dance, which has drawn thousands over the last 2 years. Review the documents on our website, which include administrators planning to ban all students from use of the Assembly Hall, a facility funded and operated with mandatory student fee money. Documents also reveal that administrators scrutinized SCFI's registration paperwork and university bank accounts, and the Vice Chancellor for Student Affairs and her top acolytes purposefully scheduled the event at times that would be unpopular or difficult for large groups of Illini fans to attend.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess that knife cuts both ways. Free speech is free for everybody, and, you know, I mean, I understand that argument. I don't think I necessarily agree with it, because you're not talking about speech necessarily. It's not, it's an action. I guess I have trouble with where does action become speech? You know, is it free speech if I like go throw a rock through your window? Is that me expressing free speech?
Right.
Or if I stand out in front of your house and yell, I think you're a poopy head, you know, well, that's, I'm expressing my opinion. I'm speaking.
Right.
No, that's fair. But throwing a rock for you in is different. So saying, I love Chief Illiniwek, okay, that's free speech. Dancing and portraying it, that's an action. That's different. So I don't know. That's just my take.
I mean, you know, ultimately, I think, you know, the event took place. No harm, no foul. Like, right? You know, Romano and the rest of them, you know, we have bigger fish to fry. And besides, most of these trustees are already out for a whole lot of other scandals.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for making my degree worth about, you know, what I can wipe my butt with, guys.
Oh, come on now.
Hey, all I'm saying is, you know, Herman and the rest of them, and, you know, it just seems like, you know, it feels like, you know, between this and, like, the Kiwan case and everything, it feels like I'm in Mississippi when I'm actually in central Illinois.
I know. It's a very strange place. It's very conservative area, really. When you hang around the campus, you forget where you are, really, I think. Because if you go outside of the campus area and just hang around people in town, it's a very different world around here. This is not, you know, it's down south, really.
Oh.
I heard somebody describe it that way. It's like, once you're out of Chicago, you're in the south. And I think they're really right. This is the south in a lot of ways.
I mean, it's really kind of disheartening. You know, like, I'm just reading some of the dailyillini.com comments right now. You know, that wonderful thing that disguises itself as a newspaper.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
These emails demonstrate the corruption of the administration. No, I thought the Cloutgate scandal did that quite well prior to this. It simply astounds me that these folks completely regard the many students and alumni who hold the chief in our hearts forever. Foundation weekend is a bad idea. That's the perfect weekend. The chief had been foundational for many of us to respect Native American culture. Really, if there wasn't a Chief Illiniwek, you would have been... Stupid Native Americans?
Yeah,
I don't even know what they're talking about.
Well, don't you remember? I mean, that was the big scandal right before the chief was officially retired. Was there was a Facebook group called, If They Get Rid of Chief Illiniwek, I'm Going to Become a Racist. That was a Facebook group. That was where they made the death threats against a Native student here. You know, I mean, there's really a very fine line between... racism as in, I think this is like the greatest thing, and racism as in, I think this is the worst thing in the world. I mean, there's not much of a difference, really. And they express that all the time. We get that in interviews and stuff when we interview people at these events. There's the chief is great. And if it weren't for the chief, then everybody would realize that Indians were a bunch of stupid, drunk, lazy, you know. It's like, whoa, what? You know, it's like, it's out there. They're thinly disguising racism.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like it's a red-faced minstrel show that they hold every year, and thousands of people are going to these events, and that's kind of a a scary thing. I mean, last week we talked about the UND and their affiliations with Nazism.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, they're right. Yeah, they're one of their big bankrollers was is an aficionado of Nazi memorabilia. I don't know if we can actually call him a Nazi, but he seems to like to collect a lot of Nazi memorabilia, celebrate Hitler's birthday, you know, things
he
like
that. He had that that painting. What was the guy's first name again?
He was Ralph Engelstad. So the painting was to Ralphie from Adolf, and it's a painting of Ralph Engelstad, I guess, sort of morphed into
Hitler.
Yeah, wow. Wearing Hitler's uniform and everything.
If it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck.
Yeah, but this guy actually really bankrolled the university to, and as a condition for the massive grants that he gave the university, private endowments and everything, he built this arena named after himself for their hockey contest, and had the Sioux Head logo embossed in the back of every single seat.
Yeah,
and this happened around the time when there was sort of a debate about whether we should drop the Fighting Sioux mascot and the Fighting Sioux logo, and you know, all of a sudden he shows up with, you know, $500 million donation to the university, but the condition is we have to have it permanently stamped on a building in the university. You know, it's scummy.
Well, there's an interesting book that I don't know if you've seen. A couple of U of I grads from days gone by wrote a book a while back called Race as Spectacle in Sports. Did you ever see that?
I've not.
Or Racism as Spectacle? I think, no, it's Race as Spectacle in Sports. It's King and something Wood. Anyway, but one of their arguments is that there's sort of a lot of racism built into sports. Like that once sports became desegregated, it became a sort of a place for bringing in sort of trophies of colonialist trophies, you know, and like, you know, promoting black bodies as almost like you would thoroughbred racehorses or something. You put them out there, you know, you preen them, shine them up, and it's like, look what my possession, you know, it's a very possessive, like controlling sort of thing. And so it really does go together, really well with the whole mascot thing. I mean, that fits right into it, this whole, like, you know, white supremacy sort of thing. Like, we control these things and we own these things. And
yeah, well, there was an earlier show where we were discussing sort of the differences in language when sports commentators would talk about, like, white athletes versus black athletes. They'd when it was a black athlete, they'd say things like, you know, naturally gifted, or, things that would make it seem like it was just his body that was, the great performer. And then when it was a white athlete, it would be, you know, a mentally agile, these other sorts of things, which sort of, you know, it's very thinly veiled racism, but it really is there. Yeah,
we can all expect it to be as, brilliantly open as when Rush Limbaugh was on ESPN.
No, you got to hand it to Rush. He's pretty much right out there. He's a racist. He's a lot of things.
And speaking of racists and white supremacists, we'll be back in a minute or two with our Better Known Owner segment, which ties into both native imagery with the Washington Redskins and their former owner, who is quite a noted racist. So we'll be back in just a minute with our Better Known Owner segment after we get our little song in as our little gift to all owners.
Take a bottle, and your wife's worried, picture what her lipstick is. direction. They keep realizing she's not worried that she's no tax injections. They all the commotion call the crash, shit, clear. The thrill until you beer, shot diamonds from the beer. And your Ferrari break down, and your chauffeur get high. Smash up your stretch rolls, I put Rodeo Drive. All the breaking back to others where you got all your bucks. So we make the revolution, I just hope your life sucks. All my people in the place, put your fist in the air. All my down, get up out of your chairs. All my real down, and we got love for you here. Step for that, right there. Get em. Champagne, not rum, and your Pinot be sour. Get up, stuff you dip in the 96% flour. Get a famous rapper, you believe to your own, a sweet 16. Get some pride and walk out, get some room with this clean. Squad you high, you bad with instructions. And by mistake, be at your mansion with the street people. Ladies, make your party, guess what's in their white Russians. And die behind a Jimmy Martin, crying and cussing. Make your chef be on, and then you whisk in the kitchen. May I assume your autobiography is filed in the picture? Cause only breaking back to others where you got all your cash. So we make the revolution, I hope your life sucks, man. All my people in the place, put your fist in the air. All my family, get up out of your chairs. All my real damn people, we got love for you here. Except for that, right there. Get em.
Hello and welcome back for our last segment. I want to thank Tom Garza for being in here talking about indigenous rights and Native Americans and racism as it appreciates in cultural appropriation and sports. That last point you had made was a perfect segue into this colonialism and, you know, pulling out trophy athletes. For George Preston Marshall, he was the former owner of the NFL Washington Redskins. And since his inception as owner, he had opposed African-Americans in football. For 24 years, Marshall was identified as the leading racist in the NFL. He propelled the NFL to institute a color barrier like that of baseball. As a result of Marshall's prodding, players, owners like Pittsburgh Steelers' Art Rooney, who had hired a black player on his first team and strongly professed his belief that black and whites were equal to him, and Chicago Bears' George Halas, who also believed that blacks should be able to play, fell into line. From 1934 to 1945, no blacks played in the NFL. While the rest of the league began signing individual blacks in 1946, and actually drafting blacks in 1949, Marshall held out until 1962 before signing a black player. He had stated that, "We'll start signing Negroes when the Harlem Globetrotters start signing whites." Wow. The Hail to the Redskins theme song originally contained the verse, "Fight for Old Dixie," to pander to the team's southern fanbase. And it was later changed to Fight for Old D.C. Marshall had the team's marching band play the Confederate anthem Dixie at halftime. As we mentioned, 1962 was Marshall's first signing of a black player. This signing only came when Interior Secretary Stuart Udall issued an ultimatum. Unless Marshall signed a black player, the government would revoke the Redskins' 30-year lease for RFK Stadium, which had been paid for by government money and was owned by the Washington City government, which is then and now formerly an arm of the federal government. Marshall's chief response was to make Ernie Davis, Syracuse's All-American running back, his number one draft choice for 1962. Davis, however, had other plans and demanded a trade, saying, quote, "I won't play for that SOB." He got his wish as the team sent him to Cleveland for All-Pro Bobby Mitchell. After his death in 1969, in his will, Marshall left a considerable endowment to fund a charity dedicated to helping underprivileged children in the Washington, D.C. area. The document, however, contained a provision that stipulated no money was to be used to help minority children.
Oh.
This provision was later dropped in a lawsuit. So that's so. George Preston Marshall, a fitting end to just this overt racism compared to the less than overt racism as it comes to cultural appropriation in sports. So we will hit you back next week for another episode of Not Another Sports Show here on 104.5 FM.